Hey, here we are again at Old School Guns. We have the opinion, the news, and the answers to the questions that you are asking. So let's just jump right into it. Number one, I'm back from my captivity in New York State. Had to go there for some work-related things and stay for a while. Not a very happy place. I mean, upstate New York, beautiful country, very nice people, but I didn't see any gun stores, and I don't think that they're allowed to have too much Second Amendment freedom. I mean, it is definitely occupied territory, and one of the things that really came across was the fact that one of the natives up there said, well, the people in the big city make the laws, and we have to follow them, even though we don't like them or agree with them. So it always tells you, get out there and defend the Second Amendment. Work through your legislators, work through your any kind of elected officials, work through your gun organizations. The Second Amendment, once you lose even a part of it, it is very, very difficult to get back. And things like magazine bans and rifle bans, those things are very, very tough to overturn and come back from. So it's better to be proactive and not let those things get started in the first place. So let's go right into news. We don't have too many monkey shines from the Democrats. You know, they all kind of mention gun control, but, you know, when they first started out and when they would announce, they would try to make that a centerpiece of what they were doing in their campaign. And I don't think that it's particularly working. I think what you're going to see is whoever is the eventual Democratic nominee will have some sort of anti-gun plank in their platform, and they'll pay some lip service to it to keep their radical base happy. But I don't know that they're going to make that a centerpiece of the campaign. It just doesn't seem to be having a lot of traction right now, which is a good thing for us. A good thing for us, because frankly, the the NRA is in a little bit of turmoil and is still in some disarray. And as I look at it, there are a couple things that are pretty obvious, and one of the most obvious ones is the president of the NRA is a figurehead. Oliver North was a figurehead. The last one that had any probably real power and real influence was probably Charlton Heston. I think if Heston had wanted LaPierre and Cox out, he could have done it. I mean, he would have told the board this is how it's going to be, and they would have gone along with him. But I think that Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox, you know, face it, they run the NRA. They run it. It's they are the boss and the second boss, and the directors basically fall in line behind them, most of them anyway. And the president is really a figurehead who kind of says what they does and says what they do and what they say to do. So I would say that, you know, that it is what it is. And to work in Washington, you know, those guys know the ins and outs. And some of these guys, and it's Pincus, it's the guy from Military Arms Channel, it's a couple other of these YouTube guys, they think they're going to reform the NRA. Well, they're not going to reform shit. These guys are small-time dudes who can put up some interesting content, but they couldn't even begin to run an organization that complex. They don't know the relationships that are important, the ones they have to keep growing and keep developing. So at this point, I don't think they're doing anything that's really productive. And they're certainly not going to be the agents of change. And they're not going to force change. They just sort of are these pip-squeaking voices in the background. And, you know, I think a scare had to have been thrown into the NRA leadership these last couple months. You know, they don't like having a public break where they got to get rid of their president and all the acrimony with this Ackerman McQueen crew that's been basically handling a lot of the NRA stuff for a couple of decades now. And there are obviously some problems that have to be cleaned up. I think they'll be a little more circumspect about wardrobe spending and a few things. But you know, the fact of the matter is, it is a FUD organization. And I say that not FUD as a pejorative, but it is kind of a hunting-oriented power base there. You know, the people who are there, they're the people who are there have, you know, the $30,000 shotguns. I mean, they hunt in Africa, they hunt in Mongolia and go after the rare game animals. That's kind of the underlying power base of the NRA and its board. You know, a lot of those guys do that. Yeah, there's some law enforcement and there's some a few ex-military, not as many as there should be, but there's a few. And there's some other things going on there. But, you know, you're talking about the moneyed, connected, influenced people who are pro-gun and are a part, and have the time and the money to devote to that organization. You know, a regular guy like me does not. I mean, I have a life membership, but I can't afford $20,000 or $30,000 a year to hobnob and do all this stuff. I have to work for a living. And so I'm like most NRA members. I have a contract with the organization. Hey, I've paid you some money, and I donate when and where I can, and I need you to stick up for gun rights. And what I mean by sticking up for gun rights is not only stopping onerous laws from getting passed, but trying to peel some of this back. And we've talked about it. We've talked about peeling back parts of the NFA. You know, short-barreled rifles, the prohibitions and controls on those don't make sense anymore. A lot of those things don't make sense anymore. Not having an open registry does not make sense anymore. Stopping us from collecting some of these historically significant weapons simply because they're select fire. There's going to be no Vickers machine gun on its tripod ever used in a crime. It's just not. So, therefore, regulating them is a waste of time. So, I really want to see some reform like that, and that's part of the contract that I feel that, you know, the NRA has with its members. It also does need to protect habitat and hunting and all that, because that's a legit part. You know, we use the word FUDs, but that is a legit part of the thing. I come from a family of hunters. As a matter of fact, I'm probably the only guy in my family who was really more of a target shooter and military arms guy. And all the other males in my family were outdoorsmen were basically hunters. So there's a lot of FUDs out there, and we need them on our side. We need them paying dues, and we need them to understand the importance of the protecting the Second Amendment for everyone and reeling some of this nonsense back. You know, and a couple other areas that could be peeled back that would be beneficial, not for me personally, but I think for the community at large would be, you know, some of these departments of natural resources and some of these gaming laws and things. You know, we don't really delve into that. We just kind of accept them and abide by them. But there needs to be some review there, too, as far as what calibers are suitable for what and how to harvest game and all the rest of it. And that works hand in hand with habitat protection and the management. So hopefully there's a lot of common ground that can go on. But these pipsqueaks who are sowing dissent, these guys have always been around. There have been guys who've been complaining about the NRA and their fundraising, and they accuse these guys of riding around in limousines, which is probably true, on some cases anyway. But, you know, they say, why? I'm a hardworking middle-class guy. Why should I give money so that other people can have fancy clothes and ride in limousines and on charters? And the answer is, you know, that's just the world that the NRA operates in. It's important to know that there are two different aspects to the NRA. There's the traditional NRA, which supports marksmanship and all of that. You know, all the competitions and the training and all of that. That is kind of separate from the Institute for Legislative Action. And legally, they have to be kind of separate entities. Institute for Legislative Action should be going after some of these dopey gun laws and pursuing them in court. And frankly, I don't think they're aggressive enough. I think that there's a lot of areas where, you know, at least they could file an amicus brief in some of this stuff. And it's amazing to me, you see some of the smaller organizations going after these gun laws in court, and they have had some reasonable success. The magazine, even though it was temporary, the lifting of the magazine ban in California, I thought that was funny. Whether they're ultimately successful, I don't know. I think the case, I was hoping the Supreme Court would hear it. I thought the case of Class 3 items in Kansas is going to be a very interesting case. And here's why the Supreme Court did not want to hear it. I guarantee. If you look at precedent as far as what people are actually doing in the country, there is nothing wrong with Kansas passing, which they've done, the Second Amendment Protection Act, saying that basically, you know, federal gun laws don't apply. And that means that I can manufacture a suppressor. If I'm a resident of Kansas, I can manufacture a suppressor. I don't have to register it with the feds. And as long as I keep it in the state of Kansas, I'm good to go. Now, the federal authorities do not see it that way. But a similar situation exists with marijuana laws. Marijuana is still a federal bust. It's still a federal crime, and it's not federally exempted on any level on the federal laws. However, states have come out and they did the medical use of marijuana, then now it's recreational use. That is still against federal law. And if it's good enough for marijuana, it's good enough for Class 3 items. So I should be able to make, if you live in Kansas, you should be able to manufacture a Class 3 item, be it a select fire or fully automatic weapon or a suppressor, or even things that are considered Class 3, like a short-barreled rifle, just do that, not register it. You should be able to do that under the same logic that these other states are allowed to have medical and recreational marijuana. Now, I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but I'm telling you, the precedent is there. And the precedent, the reason they didn't hear it was if they turned down the gun owner and said, no, you can't do that, federal law reigns supreme, that then creates a precedent for the marijuana. And that means that all these state laws which allow medical and recreational marijuana will all be void and there'll be federal prosecutions. So, you know, that's a very, very interesting case, and it's got ramifications. And frankly, I just think we need to live in a more free country. You know, I do have some strong views against drugs, and part of the reason why is I don't really care what somebody does in their home. They want to blow their mind out with marijuana, that's fine. But I can't have them on the street, high as a kite, driving a dump truck, driving a crane, or driving a school bus. I can't have it. Just cannot have it. They're impaired, and they cannot be doing that. Now, you can make the same. You can make the same argument against alcohol. Well, there's laws against drunk driving, and that's just a societal choice that we've made. We made that in 1933 that we were going to lift the prohibition, and we know alcohol does bad things, but at least alcohol is controllable. And the other thing is, we don't have alcohol saturated products that are getting into kids' hands the way the brownies and cookies and candies and some of these other things are in states that have legalized recreational marijuana. Plus, it puts people in a very bad position. The brick of marijuana, which is legal in Colorado, across the Kansas border, will wind you up in jail for a long time. So we kind of need some laws that are uniform, so we don't have these problems. You know, and society is very polarized on this. People do not want to have their guns taken away, rightfully. There is a segment of the population that wants their marijuana. There's a segment of the population that want their illegal alien friends and no border security, no border controls at all, and unlimited immigration. There's a segment of the society that wants abortion on demand, apparently until birth. And these are all very, very polarizing issues. But immigration is like marijuana. You know, if you're a sanctuary city, you're in violation of federal law. If you're not cooperating with ICE and Homeland Security and the rest of it, protecting and shielding undocumented, i.e. illegal immigrants, you're in violation of federal law, and that's a bad thing. But it's the same as the suppressors and class 3 items that you should be able to manufacture in Kansas. It's got to be one way or another. We either obey federal law or we don't, or we have latitude. And if the latitude is, hey, if the federal law's on the books, we're just going to go along with it, that's fine. But if the state wants to pass a different law and live under a different set of rules, if that's okay for marijuana and that's okay for illegal immigrants, it's got to be okay for guns too. And that's one of the reasons that the Supreme Court does not really want to handle cases like that, because they realize the domino effect of these kind of decisions and the repercussions that they could have later on. Not that the Supreme Court is ever really as advertised the great last word. You know, if you go back through history, they upheld Jim Crow laws and things that we would consider to be completely unacceptable today, were actually Supreme Court precedences which have been overturned through the course of time. So a lot to think about, and there's a lot at stake in this next election. And the monkey shines, the fools with their antics and all of their nonsensical stuff are diverting attention from the real issues, which are: what kind of a country do we want to be? How permissive a society? Do we make and enforce rules that protect our society? And that'll be interesting to know. And it's interesting to see now. We thought measles was extinct, and it's made a comeback. Other diseases are going to be the same way if illegal immigration is not checked, if it's not stopped. And we'll be taking steps backwards in quality of life. If you've ever seen a child with measles, you know it's not very pleasant, and some children die from it. I mean, it's a lot of childhood diseases were very, very serious, and we've worked for decades, 50, 60 years, to eradicate some of these, and we just can't turn around and let it go. Okay, on another note, let's get to what is really my favorite portion of the show, which is questions and answers. Here are some of the questions and answers that have come up. The first one is, did you see the InRange TV Q&A question about the Desert Eagle? And I have to tell you, I'm a fan of InRange TV. I like them, but I don't always agree with them. So when I disagree with them, understand that, you know, it goes back to my belief that if everyone in the room is thinking the same, you need to find another room. And that question was, is there any rational reason for owning a Desert Eagle? And I think it was Carl said no, and then they move on to the next question. Well, I covered this in a previous podcast, but I'll just go over it very quickly again. The reason you own a Desert Eagle is, there's several reasons to own it. Number one, it's cool. It's been in movies and television, and people like owning cool things. That's not maybe the greatest reason to own it, but it is a legit reason. The fact that you want it, you like it, and you want it. The next reason is, it's an excellent gun for handgun hunting and metallic silhouette shooting or engaging targets at long distance, you know, in a handgun hunting setting, you know, whether it's steel, you know, the metallic silhouettes or whatever it is. And, you know, it's really excellent at that. I've shot tighter groups with the Desert Eagle 44 Magnum than I have with any 44 Magnum revolver. So performance-wise, if you're shooting a 44 Magnum, it is an excellent choice, accuracy-wise. It's got an adjustable trigger. It's heavy. You don't have a lot of recoil. Comparatively speaking, the recoil is a little more gentle. It's got some muzzle flip, but that's not a bad thing. You know, it dissipates some of the energy. And it's really, really very shootable for a 44 Magnum. I've not shot the 357, but I've seen them. And that is kind of an almost zero recoil, kind of 10-shot deal. A cool gun, no real self-defense application. You could get the same performance in a much lighter package in 357 SIG, I think. But it's still a very cool gun. And again, it serves whatever you want to shoot a 357 Magnum at, hunting-wise or steel silhouette-wise or bowling pin-wise, whatever that is. And then there's the 50 A&E, which is essentially, I mean, it's a brute and it's a powerhouse, and it's always kind of argued in the, you know, what's the best handgun for a bear, which is a really obtuse, strange argument because people really don't go after bears with handguns. But it's a powerful handgun, again, exceptionally accurate, and somewhat easier to shoot than are going to be these Super Magnum handguns in 500 Smith & Wesson or some of the other, you know, even a 480 Ruger. You know, I don't talk about that much, but that's a powerful handgun also. Those above 44 Magnum handguns, the Super Magnums, they are, you know, they can be a challenge to shoot. And the 50 A&E is really one of the more pleasant ones to shoot. So that's why you would own it. That's why you would own it. It's fun to own, and that's why people do it. So I think that, you know, it's just to play it off, no, in a two-gun military style, police style, defense style match, it would not be the thing to use. It's heavy. It's very ponderous. But if you were shooting 100-yard pistol targets and had to knock them down, heavy steel targets and knock them down, something his 9mm will not do, then it comes into its own. Just like any tool for a specific application where power and accuracy are needed at range, it might be the one that you would turn to instead of a revolver. So that's why people want to own them. Plus, there's a certain flair and panache with them that people like, and I'm somewhat less affected by that, but there are people who, you know, they love the way it looks, they think it's cool, and that's been predominantly through the entertainment media, video games and movies. So that's why you would own a Desert Eagle. Next question is, what guns which guns you don't like and would not own? I had to think about this for a while. There are very few guns I really wouldn't own. The low-end stuff, I'm not interested in. I'm just not interested in High Points and Lorsons and whatever all those are. I'm not interested in those. Just Phoenix Arms, no. Not interested in any of that. I'm not interested in Glocks. I don't really care for polymer-framed guns. You know, they are cost-effective. I mean, you can get... And I'm not just talking about Glock. There's Steyr. There's Smith & Wesson. There's Heckler & Koch. There's a variety. There's Walther. There's a variety of these, you know, polymer frame service handguns, which do an excellent job. If you're a police officer, they're great. If you want to shoot large quantities of 9mm ammo, these are great. They're good guns. They don't particularly do anything for me. Although at some point I might pick one up just to use as a carry piece or self-defense gun, simply because they're, compared to other guns, they're economically priced and they're fine for that. They're good guns for that. But I don't particularly like them. I don't see a lot of the gun maker's art in them. I see innovative design, of course, but I don't see a lot of the gun maker's art. I don't see a lot of the beautiful metal shaping and finishes and things that I personally appreciate. I personally appreciate those things. But they're not something that I always look for in a carrier use gun because, you know, I don't want to mess up a gun with a nice finish. Back in the 60s, hey, it was okay. Go buy your Smith & Wesson Model 27, carry it in a holster, and hey, if the finish wears off it, no problem. last resort, you could always send it back to Smith & Wesson and they could, you know, reapply the blue and nobody'd be any the wiser. But these days, that's kind of gone. You can't get those beautiful finishes from years past back. So I would sit there without spending a fortune. You probably could spend a fortune and do it, but most people aren't going to do that. So those are guns I like. The trend I find that is comical, and I mean comical in a good way, is that they're trying to match them out. And whether it's, there's a VP9-1, there's Walther has made a couple of the Q5 in both polymer and now steel frame. They designed a polymer gun, service gun, turned it into a polymer target gun, and now it's a steel framed target gun based on the polymer design. So there it is, going full circle. It just goes to show you that, you know, when ultimate performance, meaning accuracy, is kind of demanded, they always seem to go back to the steel frame and the tight tolerances, all those things that that people derided the auto pistols of the pre-1990 auto pistols for, was, well, they're too tight, they'll jam if they're dirty, or, you know, on and on and on. So it is funny to watch that go back and see that happen. But those are some guns I really wouldn't care for. Now, guns that are inexpensive and a good value that I do go for is, I love the Star Auto pistols. A lot of people think, oh my God, you know, these are terrible. But the Star pistols that served in Spanish service are very good, reliable guns. Very, very good, reliable guns. 1911 pattern. I love the Star BM. You can buy those for $179 now. Probably not with a beautiful finish, but it can be had for a reasonable price, $179. It's reliable. It's there. And magazines are like $20, which is about what you pay for any magazine these days, especially the aftermarket ones. Some of the factory ones can run up $35-$40. But yeah, you can get those guns. They're very reliable. They're proven. They're good. They are kind of no frills, but I really like them. The Star BM is a great little carry gun. A little heavy, you know. I got it because I always wanted a 9mm combat commander. You know, a gun that would be fairly soft shooting, but, you know, a little more compact than a 1911. Something you could carry. I got that. It is a little heavy. I don't really care for that aspect of it, but it's a good, solid, reliable gun. And I've also got a Star Model A, and even though that's in the weird 9mm Largo caliber, it's a lot of fun to shoot. Not tremendous recoil on it, and definitely a very cool design. If you've ever broken one of those down, it's the slide stop is also the takedown lever. Very, very cool how they engineered that. And so I really like that. Mine's got finish on it that's so worn, it just looks like gray metal, and that has a beauty all its own. It has a beauty all of its own. So I really like both of those guns. There's other ones out there, you know, usual kind of comm block type things, depending, going from anywhere from about $200 to $400. There's a tremendous variety of surplus and surplus style pistols out there that are really good values, and the ones that have been used by the police or military will go up in value. They may be cheap now. A Yugoslav M70, which is a 32 ACP, kind of a small mini Tokarev in 32 ACP, that gun is about $200 now, and it will go up in value. Buy it, and all of a sudden, 7 or 8 years from now, it's going to be selling for twice that. Same thing with the Yugo M57s have been pretty stable at about $200 to $250 for 8 or 9 years. But eventually, they're going to dry up, and then people will want them. And there's also Tokarev pistols coming in from, I think, Romania and a few places. Those are all going to be a value that, if you're going to hold on to something for a period of time, they're going to go up, and it'll surprise. Someday you'll look up the price, and you'll be very, very surprised. So those are guns I like. Guns I don't like, I just don't. There's not very many of them, and they're all pretty much low end. But I like and respect a lot of different guns. So that's the answer to that question. Okay, another question is, did you watch CN Arsenal's Project Lightning with Ian McCollum, May, and Othias? And the answer is I did, and I've commented on this before. I was not impressed. I thought it was a hodgepodge of guns. It was thrown together. They tried to draw some conclusions from tests that really didn't have the kind of measures of performance or have the kind of measures of effectiveness whereby you could make a lot of comparisons. And I'll say that because I think there is a real mistake there. Something like, they called them all light machine guns, which the MG0815 is not a light machine gun. It is somewhat more portable than its earlier brother, the MG08, but it is not light, and it is certainly not an automatic rifle. They did have a couple of light machine guns there. The Lewis and the Madsen are genuine light machine guns. The Chouche, Chosho, and the BAR are automatic rifles. And an automatic rifle is fundamentally different than a light machine gun. A Bren gun is a light machine gun. A BAR is an automatic rifle. And a BAR is designed so that it's very portable and it can bring firepower to decisive points on the battlefield very quickly, like when you're attacking. It's excellent for that. It can also be used, you can position a couple of them at a key point, and they can really bolster your defense. So it's a gun that can be moved around very quickly, and it's a gun that can actually influence battles just by the nature of its mobility and its effectiveness and reliability. So the answer is, yes, I did see it. I just thought that they had different kinds of guns in different states of repair. To me, the winner was the BAR, although their test results did not reflect that. And the reason I say that is their own gunsmith even admitted that it was the only gun that showed up working, the only gun that worked continuously throughout their testing, and the only gun that basically went home working without a lot of gunsmithing to the magazines or the mechanism and some of the other parts. So you could attribute some of that to age of the older guns, of the other guns, but you know, the BAR was there too, and the BAR was the same age, but it was the clear winner. The other thing is you should never test guns like that just on a flat range. If you really want to get a feeling of how it was, and I understand flat ranges are a fact of life most places, but if you got on some terrain, and especially if you had broken terrain, things like creek beds and even some things that resembled shell holes and kind of landscape like that, you would find, and rubble, you know, all those good things that you find in a war zone, you find that the BAR would be even better because you don't need a bipod, you have plenty of things to rest it on, plenty of cover to get behind, and it's such a light maneuverable gun compared to the others that it really would come into its own and they would see the value of it. So I would say that's a big part of it. The other thing that the testing methodology is, you really don't see, and I'm sure they're very nice people, but the young lady there, you know, she doesn't have the upper body strength. Those are kind of primitive design guns compared to nowadays, especially. And they require upper body strength that many females just don't possess, even nowadays. I mean, you don't see females in the NFL. You don't see them in the NHL. You don't see them in Major League Baseball or professional basketball. And there's a reason for that, because the vast majority of women have a biological difference and they don't have the upper body mass that males do. Although there are some weightlifters and things that could definitely do that, but they're pretty much outliers and anomalies. So having someone who is at a natural disadvantage testing these things is really not going to get you the kind of results you're looking for. It just isn't. The other thing is, there's a lot of, even guys who've been in the military would find it pretty challenging to handle some of the mechanisms of these older guns. Things like the Lewis, even good ones like the Lewis gun. It would be very difficult. Even the MGO 815, which is pretty straightforward, although most military people are used to and have fired belt-fed weapons, the continuous cloth belts are a lot different than the disintegrating links as far as how you kind of deal with those and the things you have to look for as far as cartridges being pushed around in them. You know, there's just a lot of things that probably, I don't want to say a lost art in firing some of those older guns, but they are definitely a challenge. And if you're going to do that, I think you need a much more robust effort to get them tested. And then, you know, they kind of did some foolish walking fire things and all that. That was just a waste of ammo, in my opinion, a waste of ammo. So it was interesting, but it was kind of the internet gun content version of just junk TV. It was just kind of like watching reality TV, and it really didn't do much for me. It didn't really scratch any historical itch. It didn't inform me on anything other than these weapons are, there's still some out there. They're very interesting, but there's a lot of obsolescence, except for the BAR. I would say every one of them was completely obsolete, and I would say the BAR was obsolescent, but it's still much more modern than the other guns that were out there. So I know that InRange likes to throw a lot of shade on the BAR because of their vast experience in two-gun matches and evidently this, but I've known people who've actually used it, and that generation is getting a lot older, and they're not going to be around forever, but I've never seen a weapon that was liked as much as the BAR, and that goes down to being an infantryman, and none of those people doing the test seem to have a military background. Infantrymen love powerful, reliable, and durable weapons, and that goes for a lot. That's one of the reasons the Kalashnikov is so loved by a lot of people these days, even though it's becoming technically inferior to the latest ARs. I mean, it's not as modular. It doesn't have this, that, and the other thing, but it is about 90% or higher as good as an AR in the things that matter. And just as an observation, I will have to say that, and this had nothing to do with Project Lightning, but watching some of the match videos, when I see people tossing, and I've mentioned this before, tossing magazines and tossing rifles is really onto the dirt or into dumpsters, you know, just kind of clowning for the camera. You know, that's bogus. We're trying to teach people how to handle weapons responsibly. And I'm sure that they're very careful and they check it before they go through their antics and make sure it's not loaded. But it doesn't look that way. And they look like they're trying to be cool guys. When I saw like one guy toss his, I think it was Carl, toss his AK onto the ground, that's BS. Because if kids are watching that, they're going to think that's how the cool guys operate. And that's not how cool guys operate. That is how fools operate. And had there been a round in that, you could definitely have had an accidental discharge of some kind, and with the tragedy that goes along with it, you could have had that. Magazines cost money. I mean, when I saw Ian throwing around FNFAL magazines in one of his videos a few months back, I just thought how stupid it is. That's a $25 to $30 item that you're tossing around. And I mean, maybe they get so many Patreon subscribers that that's just chump change. But someday that's going to be a $100 magazine. I guarantee it. I mean, we used to buy FN magazines for $5 to $7. Now you buy them and they're $25 to $30. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much longer we have to live to see the $100 magazine, but definitely it's not going to be, treating them like that is not going to be the way to go. So those are some of the things that I've observed. I really don't like mugging and clowning for the camera. I mean, put out good content, make it informative, and make it as interesting as possible. Now, again, I like those guys. I like In Range TV, and I really like Forgotten Weapons also. Forgotten Weapons has got some very interesting firearms on it. He puts out almost a video a day, if not a video a day. I find about a third of them very interesting that I watch. Some that are just on very obscure weapons, I really don't. He put out one just recently on essentially a copy of a Italian Beretta 1934-1935, kind of a last-ditch pistol. And I really like that because I like the Beretta 1934 pistol. I mean, I think it's one of the coolest little pistols, and not very powerful. The 380 is there, or it goes down to 30-32 in this in the M35. But not very powerful, but they are neat. They are interesting pieces of history. And I really appreciate that he brings some of that there. There are a lot of variations. No matter how much you think you know, there are a lot of variations, and there's a lot of firearms out there that you've never seen before. I don't think too much of the internet forums. That's kind of another question that's coming up. Do I get a lot of good information from there? The answer is you can, but you have to put up with some BS also. The question actually was, are internet forums better than Facebook? And the answer is, Facebook is the garbage bin of gun knowledge. They close down the gun groups occasionally and all the rest of it. There's complete fools on there. And you can't even make, I don't even make comments on it anymore. Other than if it's something neat and I like it. But yeah, Facebook is garbage. And the forums have become, a lot of them have become garbage too. You know, I talked about the FAL files and some of the nonsense that goes on there. And it also becomes this habitat of, I've gotcha. You know, if you call a magazine a clip, I'm going to correct you and call you out. Or if you don't know the right variation of this, I'm going to basically call you out and embarrass you. If you don't know this, you're going to be treated like a noob. You know, and all that is just a bunch of garbage. A lot of those guys look up answers before they write it anyway. But, you know, the value I found in it is if there's a product being offered that I didn't know about that I do want or I've been looking for, you can research, you can find maybe a thread on it, or if you're researching a certain marking on an older gun, you know, a lot of those kinds of things, you can get some information there. Not that it's all sterling, not that it's all proven and factually 100% right, but you can get some decent information off those. But you can also get a real buttload of garbage opinion and antics, and some of the name-calling and things are really, really horrible. But most of them are pretty good. I think Gun Boards that's been my favorite for many years now. And I've just found that they are a little more professional than everybody else. And however, I think AR15.com, that used to be kind of a Wild West for the AR-15 crowd. A lot of real children on there. But now that Brownells has purchased it, I'm hoping that it becomes a bit more civilized and a lot more informative. There's always been good content on there, and I've enjoyed it, but some of it is pretty childish. M4Carbine.net, which was kind of Larry Vickers' pride and joy, just not active enough. And I don't know if people are afraid to post there that they're going to get criticized or what the story is, but you know, it's just not as active. So hey, if there's no new posts and things happening, I find, well, maybe I go there once a week, and then maybe I don't need to go there at all if I'm only going there once a week. So a lot of the forums are garbage, and I don't like playing gotcha with people. I like helping people find out what they have. But Facebook is garbage, and I don't like the troll posts of, you know, somebody will put a pristine 1911 A1 on there going, gee, I just bought this at a yard sale, and did I do good paying $175 for this? It's like, dude, you know exactly what you have, and you're just trolling for compliments. That's all. And frankly, it may not even be the gun of the poster. It may be just a nice picture he saw somewhere. And, you know, frankly, I don't have time for those kind of monkey shines. So anyway, that's it. Well, hey, this brings to an end another episode of Old School Guns. This is, go ahead and follow us if you're listening. We always need followers. This is Old School Guns out.